So this afternoon I would like to say a few words about two visions of practice, or two visions of why we practice. And that's something about looking at why we practice, looking at our motivations for practice, has implications for how we see meditation and see practice and see our life. And there's some interesting things we'll see. And this is a little bit of a prelude to talking about Master Baoshe and his famous fan. So we all know so well. I think many of you are familiar with this teaching on the three characteristics. Have you heard of this before? This idea. So this is a teaching that is often repeated many times in Theravada retreats and from the early Buddhist discourses, but I think all the schools of Buddhism subscribe to it. But it's the idea that there are three, sometimes it's called three characteristics or three perceptions, three ways of seeing that help to free the mind. To see the nature of things through the lenses of these three. And the Pali words are anicca, dukkha, and anatta, which is usually translated as impermanence, anicca, which I talked about last time. Dukkha is the suffering or unsatisfactoriness of things. And anatta, which is not self. And in a more maybe informal or colloquial translation, I like this idea of things change, we change, and usually this brings suffering. You know, so things change, we change, usually this brings suffering. Someone translated as, things change, it hurts, don't take it personally. Which is pretty good. Things change, it hurts, don't take it personally. So, and these are interrelated, these three. So, the way I see it is the basis is impermanence. You know, everything is changing. Everything is constantly in flux. And because of this, there's no, out of this flow of experience, there's no fixed me. There's no fixed me that I can pull out and say, this is me. This is not me. And due to this flow of experience, there's a way that there's sort of an unreliability of things. Like, we can't depend on something that's always changing. You know, so anicca, dukkha, anatta. And so it said, this is universal. This is true for everyone. This is not a personal thing. It's true whether we see it or not, whether we realize it or not. And something about to understand these or to awaken to how things are in this way. It creates the possibility for being in this world with more ease, with more wisdom. So that's a little bit of the background. And then I'll offer that this, in this first vision of practice, the reason we come to practice is because we suffer. You know, practice as a response to our dukkha, to the dukkha we have in our lives. So suffering is the most common translation of the word dukkha, and it's a pretty good translation. It includes all unpleasant, difficult, painful experiences. So that's one sense of the word dukkha. We just think about it. Of course, there is suffering in the world. There's tremendous suffering in the world. Trauma, loss, physical and emotional pain. And then dukkha also includes the small irritations, the small, the subtle sense of unease or misalignment or the sense of something is not quite right. You know, this kind of sense of, I like the word unease. So this is dukkha, the suffering, the stress, the difficulties that are part of human life. And practice, maybe we can say that Dharma practice, meditation practice, asks of us something radical, that it asks that we stop for our suffering. We stop what we're doing and we turn towards it. It's like suffering for us, dukkha for us, becomes a mindfulness bell. And so to stop what we're doing and sit still right in the middle of it. And this is just about the last thing most of us want to do. You know, it's almost against our instincts. Suffering is unpleasant, it's uncomfortable, and we want it to go away. And the last thing we want to do is sit with it. And yet, here we are. So, we didn't advertise that it was a suffering retreat. So to stop for our suffering, to sit right in the middle of it, and to meet it with kindness, to meet it with care, to meet it with compassion. This is the heart of the practice. This is the foundation of the practice. And as we said yesterday in the Q&A, compassion, this kindness, compassion, care, as the open heart's natural response to suffering. So the more we open, the more we open to our experience and we open to whatever dukkha, whatever suffering is there, compassion arises, compassion will arise. So I say the willingness to be present that we often talk about is in some ways the willingness to suffer, the willingness to be with our suffering and inhabit our humanity in this way. And then something about mindfulness, something about this alchemy of awareness builds our capacity to be with difficulties. It's like, you know, when I feel very scattered and stressed and tight and, you know, the littlest thing can set me off. You know, I'm driving and I'm, you know, it's like I'm full of buttons that someone can push, you know. You know, so I think we know that when our capacity is small, it's hard to hold difficulties. And through mindfulness practice, we're growing this capacity. We're growing this ability to hold whatever comes up, whatever difficulties come up, and let them be with them and let them pass through. Sometimes we talk about mindfulness fused with compassion. Some teachers like to use the term loving awareness. You know, and it's sort of so to meet something with loving awareness. What is that? Or a kind attention, kind awareness. And so one of the interesting propositions of practice is that the suffering that we experience is not inherent in the experience itself. It's not inherent in the content of our experience. But the suffering is actually, or the suffering that we have some agency around comes into being through the relationship with things, you know, through our clinging. You know, when we push away, when we resist, when we want more and more and more, this is what creates the sense of misalignment. This is what creates the unease. So the idea is that the place of practice is in this relationship, and is to look at this clinging, you know, this somehow conflict with how things are, or non-acceptance with how things are. So I wanted to offer just a few ways of working with dukkha and working with some of the difficulties that come up. One thing is, and I think we've all experienced this here, even if we're not fully aware of it, is the calm, the sense of ease, the sense of well-being that meditation practice can bring, retreat practice can bring. This is incredibly supportive. One teacher once, someone very agitated came to him looking for advice, and he said, and this person had a conflict with, I think the story was other people were going into the common refrigerator at night and eating the food, you know, and he was the cook. So he was agitated. He didn't have, you know, people were eating the food, like, to cook the meal. He didn't have enough to cook. And I think also his agitation was a sort of sense of, a little bit of a sense of, what is that? Righteousness, or a little bit of, you know, these people are doing the wrong thing and you got to punish them. So he went to the teacher. And what the teacher said was, to see virtue, you need to have a calm mind, you know. So to see virtue, we need a calm mind. To see the goodness in others, we need some settledness in our own being. When we're really stirred up, you know, we tend to project that out. And when we are calm, you know, we can see goodness in others. So everyone here has dropped in a way that we weren't, you know, a week ago. And this is incredibly supportive. And I think, you know, you probably noticed this, that it's like the body or the nervous system or something has these, has this rhythm. And it's, we might be a little stirred up, and as we sit, things begin to settle, just the way like a cloudy glass of tap water. You know, you just leave it alone. Just leave it alone, and it settles, and it gets clear. And then as things get calm, and as things get clear, do they stay like that forever? No. You know, there's some sense of safety in that, and there's some sense of trust in that, and out of that, something emerges, you know, something that maybe has been waiting for us, something in our heart, something that's weighing on our heart, something in our life, something in our past, And so as, you know, as things get safe and as things get, as there's some trust, it start, you know, something starts to peek out or stronger than that, you know, and says, listen to me, look at me, finally, you know. And so what the way I often think about it is that when something emerges from that space, there's it's sacred in a way. There's something there, even if it's difficult, even if we don't like it, even if there's a lot of difficult emotions around it, it's like something is being asked of us, you know, to listen. Listen to me. Listen to this. Look at me. To meet something in a new way. So it's this shift in relationship can be very beautiful, you know, even while it's difficult. So I say this some request that will keep coming back until we hear it, until we listen to it. Often if something is repetitive, you know, for myself, I think I'm not listening deeply enough. I'm not hearing it, and it will keep coming back until I hear it. So one story from retreat. I was on a long retreat about 10 years ago, 9 years ago, and in the very, like I'm describing, this very nice, calm space, and, you know, thinking it's just, this is just the way it's going to be, you know, forever. And then, all of a sudden, I started thinking about someone. And this was what we sometimes call a difficult person in my life, or had been in my life, not so much in my life. But I was thinking about this person. The more I thought about this person, the more agitated and angry I became. And the more angry I became, the more I think about this person and the story, and it kind of go on and on and on. And I really thought, oh God, what am I gonna, I can't believe I'm thinking about this person on my perfect retreat here. You know, she's spoiling my retreat. So I had some kind of, you know, difficult relationship or some kind of grievance or something. And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll call my friend. So I went down to, there was one payphone, public phone, and I called my friend who happened to live in London. And the reason I called him is he knows me very well, and he has a very, he has a lot of common sense and a lot of wisdom and a lot of humor. And I called him and I said, his name is Barney. And I said, Barney, I'm on this 1 month retreat and I can't stop thinking about so-and-so. He knows her. And we all, anyway. And I can't, it's driving me crazy. I can't stop thinking. And he just said, Max, you know, in his wonderful London accent, he said, Max, I think you can forgive her by now. And it's like, forgive her? That never occurred to me. You know, and it was like a light bulb went off. It was like, oh, I could forgive her. You know, and it was in my mind, this person had all the power. You know, and I was sort of a victim, or kind of caught in some circular thing. And he said, you can forgive her. I think you can forgive her by now. And I said, well, maybe you're right. Oh my God, I can forgive her. And so that for me, you know, this again is in the relationship. The power of forgiveness, the power of forgiving ourselves, the power of forgiving others. It is such such an amazing thing. It's like it frees us. It frees us from the person that we've been holding on to, you know, in this conflict. So forgiveness is, as we often say, is not so much about the other person. It's really about ourselves and how we're relating to it, how you know, our own suffering and our own freedom. So, you know, listening in a deep way, forgiveness, we've talked about self-compassion before, but this is always, you know, it's like sometimes we can have compassion for pain that we think is not our fault. But if there's something we think is our fault, something we're taking ownership of, some mistake we made, then that's often excluded from the self-compassion. So it's like, you know, I can kind of see maybe having self-compassion for this physical pain or this sad thing that happened to me. But what about all the ways I acted out? What about my regrets? What about my shame? What you know, that doesn't count. You know, that's not worthy of self-compassion. So including everything that is suffering, everything that is dukkha, everything that is difficult is worthy of our compassion. And one of my teachers, I remember him saying, you can try everything else, but compassion is the only thing that works. You know, and we do try everything else. And along with compassion, just wanted to say something about this idea of acceptance. And we, you know, this is a orientation towards experience that is very important, very valuable, you know, to accept things as they are, accept ourselves. But let's remember, or let's make sure, that acceptance also needs to include acceptance of our inability to accept things. You know, sometimes something is very difficult, and we may have the sort of intention to accept it, but we just, at this moment, that's not available, or that's not possible. One of my teachers has this story about, and I don't remember the details of it, but basically some difficult emotion was coming up. It was probably fear, I think, that he was working with in various ways. And he kept telling himself, you know, accept the fear. But nothing was really changing. Nothing was really moving. And there was this sense of, really this sense of fear, this panic, this anxiety. So at some point, he asked himself this question. And the question was a little bit of a litmus test to see, am I really accepting this? And the question was, if this fear, pain, whatever, if this is here for the rest of my life, is this okay? You know, and then for him, the answer was, no. So this is just something that we can reflect, you know. Brian talked about this sense of bargaining in practice. You know, there can be a kind of bargaining acceptance. I'll accept you and you go away. You know. And you can try it out and play with it. In my experience, that doesn't really work. You know, it actually takes this real shift or this real opening. And which comes with a kind of release. And then that often shifts the dynamic, softens something. So true acceptance sometimes means accepting our non-acceptance, our inability to accept. And can that be okay? Can we not make a whole story about I'm not a good practitioner, not a good meditator, I should, you know, done this by now. It's always about being where we are. And so this is one vision for why we practice, is because of our suffering. And we feel very far, very distant from that serene Buddha. And practice gives us tools. It gives us ways of meeting our experience and reducing our suffering and being more free and light and at ease in the world. So now in this second vision or this other sense of practice, we come to Dogen. And it sounds a little bit different. Because Dogen is saying something like, practice is about opening to the perfection of the moment, just as it is. That somehow, things as they are, you know, including their impermanence, including their tendency to cause suffering, are perfect in and of themselves. And this is a perfection that includes me and includes all of my problems and all of my difficulties just as they are. So it's this sense of life has always been what it is and is ceaselessly expressing exactly what it is. The whole universe, all the myriad things are experiencing themselves. All the myriad things are awakening itself. So this is kind of sort of the flavor of Dogen, right? And then this question may arise, which is, if everything is like this, if everything is so originally awakened, and when we give ourselves to the moment, we fully experience enlightenment. If this is really so, well, then why do I have to do anything? Why do I have to practice? This is the question that Master Baoshe is responding to. I formulated it a little bit differently. So if everything is so perfect, why do I feel like shit? So, let's see. So Zen Master Baoshe of Mount Mayu was fanning himself. A monk approached and said, "Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there is no place it does not reach." You know, so this is, we're saying, all of nature is Buddha nature. All of experience, everything we can possibly know, is we're all in the mind of Buddha. The nature of wind is permanent. There's no place that it does not reach. And this includes everything. Why then do you fan yourself? So he's saying, if wind is everywhere, why do you need to fan yourself? This is such a great example because it's like, so in this example, fanning is practice. Fanning is activity. Fanning is doing something. And we know that if there's a person who's fanning himself and a person who's not fanning himself, who's going to be cool? You know? Who's... you know? Even though air is everywhere, if you want wind, you need to fan. Right? Even though everything is Buddha, everything is awakened, if we want to feel what this means for ourselves, if we want to live this, if we want to have this be useful for us, we have to practice, we have to activate it. The fanning doesn't, you know, the air is already there. The fanning isn't creating something that wasn't there. In the same way, our nature, our life, has always been there. But practice, you know, expresses it. Practice brings it about. So our own nature is there, our pristine nature, but if we don't make effort, if we don't practice, we can't realize it. Something in this nature requires effort. It requires something of us. It depends on us to be activated. So the monk asks, Master, the nature of wind is permanent, and there is no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself? Although you understand the nature of wind is permanent, you do not understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere. What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere? Asked the monk again. The master just kept fanning himself, you know. Just, you know, isn't that great? It's like, it's beyond words. It's actually, it's through our response, through our activity, we make this real. One teacher, one commentator says something like, through fanning, through practice, what is originally ours becomes truly ours. What is originally ours becomes truly ours. The master just kept fanning himself. The monk bowed deeply. The actualization of the Buddha Dharma, the vital path of its correct transmission, is like this. If you say you don't need to fan yourself, because the nature of wind is everywhere, nature of wind is permanent, and you can have wind without fanning, you will understand neither permanence nor the nature of wind. So it's like, I love this because it's like it's both. It's like, to have wind, we need to do something, we need to fan. But it's also this acknowledgement that the wind is there, the air is there, the air is everywhere. It's waiting for us. And then something about holding both of these, something about holding both of these perspectives. Our true nature, which is permanent, which is everywhere, which is pervading time and space, and this truth of dukkha, this truth of suffering, this idea that we suffer and we need to make effort. And in that effort, we can cool ourselves. One teacher... Well, first I want to read you something, which is, I think, expresses a little bit of this feeling of the nature of wind is permanent, the nature of wind is everywhere. This is called "The Current of the River of Life Moves Us." What we really want to do is serve happiness. We want everyone to be happy, never unhappy, even for a moment. We want the animals to be happy. The happiness of every living thing is what we want. We want it very much, but we cannot bring it about. We cannot make even one individual happy. It seems that this thing we want most of all is out of our reach. But we were born to serve happiness, and we do serve it. The confusion is due to our lack of awareness of real happiness. Happiness is pervasive. It is everywhere, and everywhere the same, and it is forever. When people are really happy, they say, "This will last forever, even after death," and that is true. When we are unhappy, it is because something is covering our minds, and we are not able to be aware of happiness. When the difficulty is past, we find happiness again. It is not that happiness is all around us. That is not it at all. It is not this or that or in this or that. It is an abstract thing. Happiness is unattached, always the same. It does not appear and disappear. It is not sometimes more and sometimes less. It is our awareness of happiness that goes up and down. Happiness is our real condition. It is reality. It is life. In this life, life is represented by beauty and happiness. If you are completely unaware of them, you are not alive. The times when you are not aware of beauty and happiness, you are not alive. Life is consciousness of life itself. The measure of your life is the amount of beauty and happiness of which you are aware. The life of an artist, and I'll add the life of a Dharma student, meditator, is a very good opportunity for life. This is Agnes Martin. Happiness is our real condition. It is reality. It is life. It is everywhere, and everywhere the same. It is forever. And so I think that these two perspectives, or these two sides, are what we find in this beautiful imagery of awakening, the moon in a dewdrop, or the moon in a drop of water. Each of us, as drops of water, we're limited. Yet, in that drop, the entire moon is there. You know, it's not like you can't separate the drop of water from the moonlight, right? You know, they are one. They are one. And so this oneness, to hold both of these as one, the realization of this oneness of, oh, I'm an ordinary person, and I'm Buddha. You know, that oneness, maybe that is the awakening that is pointed to. And then we have this, you know, wonderful idea of, to study the whole of the Buddha way is nothing more than becoming myself, learning how to truly become myself. Realizing the oneness of ordinary human being and Buddha. And this, in this way, all of us is included. You know, all of our, what we call our good parts, our good sides, all of our difficulties, all of our suffering, is not something that we need to, for once and for all, finally delete. You know, it's this radical, profound inclusivity. All of ourselves and all of this world is included. You know, this is Genjo Koan. So I think when we offer this to ourselves, it's a great gift. It's a great gift to ourselves. And then to offer it to others, you know, to see that our own awakening is the awakening of all beings, the awakening of past, present, and future. It's like everyone comes along for the ride. And so maybe let's just sit for a minute. Thank you. May we each find the courage, the love, the acceptance for ourselves exactly as we are. And in accepting ourselves exactly as we are, may we accept the Buddha in each of us.